Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net.
I'm Dr. Marty Gensius from Kent State University, and this week on Counselor Audio Source, Michael Baracco, a school counselor at Archbishop Rummel High School in Metairie, Louisiana, speaks about school counseling 2 years after the Katrina hurricane. Mr. Baracco is interviewed by CAS contributing editor Adina Renfro-Michelle of Montclair State University.
Mike Baracco, I'd like to welcome you to CounselorAudioSource.net.
Thank you very much.
We're going to talk today about post-Katrina and school counseling, and I'd like you to go ahead and introduce yourself, please, for our audience.
Yes, I'm Michael Baracco, and I am the 8th and 9th grade counselor at Archbishop Rummel High School. We are in Metairie, Louisiana. We are just a few miles west of New Orleans, and we have been in the middle of things as regards to Katrina and after effects. And we've been dealing with it for a couple of years. For the rest of the nation, it's getting to be just a memory, a history thing, but it's definitely still going on, and there's still some counseling issues out there. That's what we're going to talk about.
Great. I wanted to differentiate, I think, because your school is a private school.
Yes.
Differentiate between when your school opened and when other schools have opened for other children. So your school opened how long after Katrina?
We opened up about 6 weeks after. And one thing to keep in mind is we were to the west side of the notorious 17th Street Canal. It was the east side that flooded, which ended up really ruining so many buildings, so many schools in New Orleans. So from the flood standpoint, that was one reason why we were able to open up sooner, much sooner than a lot of schools in New Orleans.
Okay. And the area that you're in Metairie, which is called Jefferson Parish, which is, like you said, on right outside New Orleans, most of their schools at this point are open. Is that correct?
Yes, most of the schools are open.
But that is not the case for other parishes.
No, in fact, Orleans Parish, that's the schools within the city of New Orleans, many of them are still not open, and that's what such a big issue is, just schools trying to combine, schools trying to find other facilities to open. But no, quite a few are not open still in New Orleans and also in St. Bernard Parish and parts of Plaquemine Parish. So yes, many schools are still not open.
Okay. So I just want to differentiate the fact that your school has been open for so long and there are still a lot of children who are being bused to different schools or who are not able to go to the school near them because their schools are closed. Or changed names, or changed from a middle school to a elementary school, those kinds of things. So there's not a lot of grounding for those students because their schools are changing so much.
Absolutely. And in the New Orleans area, where you go to school is really part of your identity. I think even more than other parts of the country. It's part of who you are, even as adults, when we meet people, we want to know what school did they go to. It's the first question that you ask. And so when these kids, and from elementary school to high school, the fact that they have lost the school that they go to was really a personal thing also. They're losing part of their identity and a very real loss for them. So going to another school to get educated has been a good thing as far as continuing their education. But so many of them are still dealing with that sense of loss and, as you put it, just the lack of grounding in their education.
The Catholic school system has taken in quite a few students from Orleans Parish Schools.
Yes, the latest figures are we have over 2,000 students. That's just coming from the public school system in New Orleans. So, and many others, there were schools, private schools, and parochial schools in New Orleans who also were displaced and were going to school on an offshore, that's north of Lake Pontchartrain, and to Rummel, you know, so we absorbed from the schools out here, yes, we took in many students from public and parochial.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of families who cannot afford the private school system. So those are the students right now that are being bused or going to different schools than they would have originally, those kinds of things. So I do want to make that point that there is a difference, that your students in a lot of ways are very lucky that y'all were able to open in 6 weeks and stay open. So
yeah, we were very fortunate, very lucky. Now, it wasn't just a matter of opening. It was quite a bit of hard work, and those first few weeks were really something. I remember being there the first day back, and not the school opening, just with having meetings and so forth. It was really just packed with parents from other schools. The word went out that we were going to take in students from other schools. The word got out quick that Rummel High School was going to be open. And the organizational component to that was, it could have been a nightmare, but we were blessed with many people who stayed organized, got it together, but it was quite a bit of work to absorb all these students and to get the ball rolling and then to keep our own students going and the faculty and the parents. So we were fortunate, but it was quite a bit of work.
I do want to make the point that you're known as being an all-boys school, but after Katrina, your school went co-ed. Can you talk a little bit about how the students reacted to that change and what it was like having the students come back after losing their homes and being away for so long?
Well, it was a two-sided coin, so to speak. There was a lot of excitement. And from our students' point of view, being all boys, there was certainly excitement having the girls at school, and then the girls coming in, and it wasn't just girls, but boys from other schools as well. A lot of excitement about just this new adventure, and everybody getting together, and just being a co-ed campus. At the same time, you could just feel that these kids were feeling the sense of loss of their own school and when or if they would ever go back. In fact, we made the decision that they could wear their school uniform from their previous school. And so we had a school going on where students were wearing different uniforms depending on what school they were from. And so there was a lot of excitement, but then the students really, they stayed a lot together according to which school they were from. And no major problems, you know, as far as any kind of discipline getting along with each other. The sense of we're all in this together, we all went through this together, where are we headed with all of this? So there was a sense of camaraderie. And yet you could see the sense of loss also. So it was really both at the same time.
What did you do as a school counselor to help ease the transition for some of these students?
Well, for the kids who were already at Rummel, a lot of them were dealing with issues of suddenly living in a trailer or living with grandma and grandpa, you know, 15 people in their home, losing their friends who may have been displaced. So there was a sense of easing them to their new situation, and the fact of other students coming to school. I think there was acceptance there, but you know it was also sort of okay. Well, who's this coming into my home now? You know, especially I deal with the younger kids, eighth and ninth, and they had just started high school. We were only a couple of weeks in. So normally we're dealing with that transition, and then now all of a sudden we had the big hurricane away from school for 6 weeks, and now an influx of new students. So there was a lot of transition going on as far as the transition students, and that's what we call them. In fact, they took on that identity themselves. They call themselves the transitional school, RT, they call it, Rumble Transition. And what we did, we went to a platoon system, and the transition students, most of them anyway, we were able to have an afternoon session. So they went from, say, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock. They had their own, they brought in their own counselors. There were a couple of counselors just from schools that closed, that were flooded, so they dealt with most of that. But we dealt with it also as far as just we would see them in the yard or at lunchtime in that period of time between when Rummel's morning session would close, transition school would come in about a half hour of time, and a lot of the students would mingle. I would talk a little bit to the transition kids. Most of them were getting along, but as I say, they were mostly still longing for their own school that they came from. We would just assure them that, look, things are going to be fine right now. We're making it. We're all going to school together. I remember on several occasions, the students from an individual school would have a meeting, say an administrator from a school that was temporarily closed would call together all of their students. They would meet just to sort of give them an update and get them all together. And it was a team effort, you know, amongst the administrators and the counselors.
It's real interesting that in the morning the school was Rummel, typically, although it was co-ed, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And in the afternoon, the transition students came in. So from our conversations, I remember that literally the Rummel people would pack up and walk out the door, and a whole new set of teachers and counselors and principals and everything would walk in the door. It was almost like a completely different school.
It was, and that period of time between the morning and afternoon session was really active. I in fact had parking lot duty. All faculty members have some kind of duty, and it was just, I would just hold my breath. The students and teachers from Rummel would just take off in their cars, and the transition faculty and students would be coming in, and it was a miracle. Nobody got wrecked or hurt, but we did it. But it was also a time when the students really interacted, as I say, just in the yard, and you know, we let it go to a certain extent, but then we had to push them to class, and then the Rummel students go on to practice or go home, whatever the case may be. But yeah, it was quite a scene, and it's quite amazing the way it worked out and how it worked out. But again, as I said, it wasn't an accident. It took a lot of organization. It was 99% cooperation, and that's why it worked.
How long did y'all have the transition school?
Well, we started up first week of October of that year, and we went all the way to the end.
Okay.
So we went actually maybe a couple of days into June, but you know, all the way to the end of May. You look at pictures now of the students and even some of their teams, and a lot of smiles. I think there was a lot of anguish at first, especially amongst the parents. Especially towards the end, you could see that sense of accomplishment, okay, we made this, we made it through. This was actually kind of exciting. Transition school even had its own sports teams. So it was a long school year, but we made it, and even had a couple of faculty members who stayed on and taught at the transition school. That was a scramble also, just to get the teachers. So many of them had to leave town. So it worked out for a lot of people. You know, the teachers who were there, they also were quite fortunate and thankful because they were able to keep their teaching job for those 8 or 9 months.
So many teachers also were displaced, and because the schools were flooded and unable to open, many teachers were unemployed as well. So it sounds like that first year, in a lot of ways, people just kind of stuck together, and they might have been in shock and feeling some loss, but it was more of, there's a goal here, we have to do this, we have to get through.
That's exactly right. It was a lot of adrenaline. Just personally, I could feel the adrenaline myself. I was actually quite thankful that I was able to keep my job. I was displaced in North Alabama, and we were at a camp, and I was able to get on the internet to kind of keep in touch with what was happening. And I tell you, for a while up in there, a lot of the anguish was, well, do I even have a school? Do I even have a job? So when it became clear that we were going to be opening up, it was a sense of relief. And to the point of, yeah, I'm so thankful to have a job. And I think I'm speaking at least in similar ways to so much of the faculty that, you know what? We're so fortunate to still be here and have a job that we'll do whatever it takes so that the whole transition school and the student coming in was a lot of work. We did have that goal, as you said, and we had that adrenaline, and it got us going. And there were times when it was a little tiring. It's tough to get started at school at 6:30 in the morning. But you know, we kept saying ourselves, we are fortunate, very fortunate.
It is important to note that the students were living in trailers, but so were many of the teachers as well. So you had an entire group of people, the faculty, the teachers, the custodial staff, everyone, the students, all going through the same thing at the same time in a lot of ways.
There was a day that I will always remember. It was the principal called for a faculty meeting, and it was going to be the day before school actually opened back up, and we got into the Rader room, which is a big meeting room at Rummel where we usually have faculty meetings. And at least on paper, the idea was to explain, okay, what was happening, and let's see what we're going to do here, and just to give us the course of events that was going to take place. But he said, well, let's first of all go around and talk about how everybody fared, and well, then it took off. It wasn't a faculty meeting anymore. It was a sharing. It was a retreat session, and each faculty member had the opportunity to say how they fared in the storm. And I mean, it was just unbelievable. It really hit me. Everyone in the room, and there was some that weren't there because they were still out of town. Everyone was affected, and the stories I heard was just unbelievable. You know, these were my comrades. I'm hearing stories of the teachers were saying they were rescued by helicopter. So many of the teachers just completely lost their homes. Some were living in trailers. There was a faculty member who had just had a baby, was scrambling and had to evacuate. There were faculty members who even tried to talk and couldn't because of the loss. So that's when it hit me, you know, that we all were affected. We all suffered. And again, it was a sense that we're all in this together, as bad as it was, everybody had this feeling of, you know what, we're still here, we still have a school, so we're gonna do the best we can. So the faculty members were able to empathize quite a bit with the students. So, it was a tragedy that everybody participated in. Everybody was affected, so there was empathy all around.
I'm wondering if there was a little bit of survivor guilt from the faculty or even the students who didn't have so much damage to their homes. So maybe they were able to go back and live in their homes while many of their friends lost everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, personally, I actually had a little bit of that myself. My home was not flooded, just some minor damage. And as I heard the faculty members talk and break it down and hear them talk about losing everything, I was thinking, well, you know what? This is sacred ground here. I'm not even sure if I'm even in this category. But I was able to feel it because of, I had best friends and family members who went through it and lost everything. So I was able to actually feel it from that level. We had faculty members who sort of tongue-in-cheek or maybe they were being serious or half-serious at saying that they had survivor guilt. You know, there was some of that going on. But I think most of us, we just transferred that into action. You know, opened up homes, hearts, cars, whatever we could do. I sat and listened quite a bit, just sometimes on the spur of the moment. The faculty member would start talking. And she would just talk and just go on for an hour. And I realized my position there was just to listen, you know, just to let this person know that, yeah, we feel it. We all feel it. I think even among the students, that there were some, and there were quite a few in Metairie that didn't have the flood damage. And that's where most of the damage was. And I could see them helping out the other students. We had stories of students where they took in other families, took in other students, their friends. We had cases of students taking in their friend or their cousin while their parents were still out of town, just so they could continue going to Rome. There was definitely some survivor guilt going on, but I think most of us were able to put it into action, put it to use, and I know personally the guilt turned into thankfulness and action.
So the first year really was a time of action and getting through, and so you didn't have a lot of the behavior problems. It was in a lot of ways a very smooth year, other than working with the students individually, maybe in groups in the faculty about their loss issues. But I mean, as far as behavior problems and fights and those kinds of things, that was a pretty minimum for you. Is that accurate?
Yeah, the first year, yes. And again, I think that was the sense of, for lack of a better word, a sense of excitement or maybe adventure that we're all in it together. You know, so the first year, yeah, it went remarkably smooth.
So what happened the second year? What were some differences that you saw in the students and the faculty now that they're no longer the transition school or not a co-ed school, and some of that energy might have worn off a little bit?
Yeah, I think you're hitting the nail on the head. A lot of the energy wore off, and what I started to see was a lot of discouragement, even apathy to a certain degree. And first of all, from the students, I don't know if it was so much discipline-wise, I think more academically and more just from a personal point of view, you know, certain depression, even anxiety. I know just in the students I was dealing with, I came across, for example, students who were still living in a trailer and having 10 people in the trailer and just, you know, what's the sense of doing any kind of work here? I can do it, or I can't do it. We have students who had parents who were out of town. Quite a few students who either their father or their mother were out of town because of their job. Their job moved them, so they were living with either one parent. In some cases, no parent. They were living with grandma or aunt or an uncle. It just affected their academic performance. I personally had students who parents were still jobless, just was bringing a lot of stress on the student because of the head stress on the mother or the father. So it occasionally moved into discipline as far as students who aren't doing work or doing something else, some minor discipline problems in class. You know, we deal with that anyway with teenagers. But I really think most of it was just from a personal nature, keeping their heads up, sense of a work ethic. You know, they were still dealing with things and what their parents were going through. So, you know, I just think the overall happiness of being a high school student, which is what it's supposed to be, I think that suffered for a lot of students. Now, with the adults, you talk a lot more, communicate. I think there was still a lot of determination, but as of almost 2 years later, we still have faculty members who are not in their home or still rebuilding, and you know you could see the apathy of the disgust in their speech when they would talk. You know, some days it's, you could tell somebody was dragging, and so yeah, that adrenaline from the first year turned into more of frustration, disgust, and you know there certainly were cases of families and teachers who were able to move on, and sense of a relief of at least having a home to live in. Definitely an ongoing issue.
So even at the end of last school year, you still had students and faculty living still in trailers with others, rather than that sense of adrenaline and push that you saw the first year. It's more of a sense of defeat and depression that you're seeing even in some of the students, especially with a lot of the financial issues that they're dealing with, that their parents are dealing with.
Yeah, and I can just feel it talking to a student, and maybe they don't even know what's going on or what they're feeling. But then it would start off where a student's not doing anything or doing very little, and in the course of the action taken, you know, we get the mother in, and it turns out she lost her job, still doesn't have a job. Their house isn't completed. His best friend is still living in Georgia, and so forth. So the kid is just shutting down, so to speak, on quite a few cases of these types. So yes, still dealing with it. Still dealing with it.
We're speaking in the beginning of August, so as you're getting ready, even in a few days, to start the new school year, what are some of the things that the counselors and faculty are putting in place to help the students with the sense of defeat, the sense of loss?
Well, we normally really push for getting involved and have many social events, but even more so, we want to, first of all, identify the students who are in most need, and we've done a pretty good job of that, and even if we don't know them right away, they kind of reveal themselves. We open our doors. We let them know that for whatever's happening on the outside, that where they are at is actually a family. The school that they're at is a family. We push them to get involved. We have a program going on called Greater Hope, where students actually get together Saturdays at the school, whenever, and take part in the rebuilding process, putting up sheetrock, going into the city. And this is a good thing. You know, it helps people to realize that they're not the only ones, that they're a whole city that has gone through this. So we get them involved. Now, you know, from a personal standpoint, as a counselor, I'm keeping my eyes on them. Sometimes it just takes a little hello, pat on the shoulder in the morning, you know, ask them how they're doing, make a comment just to let them know that people do care, people are worried. It's just that promoting an atmosphere of acceptance, we're here together, we're staying social, staying involved. I think I've seen the biggest problem is when a student doesn't get involved and kind of mopes around. And, you know, as counselors, we know that that's not good. That's just going to increase a sense of depression. I actually had a couple of cases this past year that we had a lot of physical illness. You know, I can think of a couple of kids in particular. And, you know, not being a medical doctor, I can't go there and tell the parents this is what I think is happening. But I think it's talking to the students there's definitely that sense of loss, sense of depression that it was contributing to, you know, the stomach aches, the headaches, the back aches, and so forth. So we deal with it on an individual basis, but mostly what we're trying to do is promote positiveness, acceptance, socialness.
Because these students who are trying to sort out their own identity have had a lot of what they consider to be their identity changed. Their home, sometimes their families. You and I had talked about a much higher rate of divorce among the parents of these students. So it sounds like you're trying to keep at least the identity of the high school and being from Rummel as complete as possible and open as possible so they can speak about the other losses and senses of who am I because I'm not from this neighborhood anymore, or I'm not the child of these two parents who have these jobs anymore, mm-hmm. Those kinds of things.
Yeah, I've been counseling 8th graders now for, 15 years. One reason I love the age is because it's a transition age, and it's an age where they're part boy and they're part young man, and the change just physically, emotionally, the change of going from elementary school to high school, that there are so many changes going on. I'll say boy, because these are the ones I deal with in a boy's life, without having a post-Katrina to deal with. You know, that I think makes it a fascinating age, beautiful age, and challenging. And so they're going through all these changes to begin with. Who am I? Who are my parents? This is the school. You know, for a lot of them, it's one of the first questions I ask them, get them in my office. Did you choose to come here or did your parents choose? And most of them say that they chose to come to Rome. So it's an important time and it was an important decision for them just to be where they're at. That's what I want to go with to emphasize. Yeah, look, you're in a good place here and a lot's happening. But you know, you want to give them that ground to stand on and let them know that, yeah, there's a lot going on here. But you know what? It's good. It's growth. And you got a few hundred students with you that are going through the same thing. So it is fascinating. It's a challenge, but a fascinating challenge.
The students who have gotten back into their homes and their parents are lucky enough to have the jobs, how are they doing as far as being able to move beyond that sense of hopelessness?
Well, most of them are doing well. And I think a lot of it depends on their personal makeup to begin with. And we're always going to have students who are able to be resilient and to deal with things, be a good student, and so forth. And there's always going to be some that struggle. And I think that this came out even in the post-Katrina world. We had quite a few students who were very resilient and who were able to move along. And even some who had a loss. They got involved, got involved with their parents and helped them rebuild. But it's those students who may have been a little more fragile to begin with who I think suffered the most. And also, as you mentioned about the divorce, it seems to me that there were quite a few students I dealt with who actually during the year, as I talked to them, they would talk about how their parents are splitting up, their parents are getting divorced. Of it, how much Katrina had to do with that, maybe a lot. In some, I could say definitely a lot. Maybe it was going to happen anyway. But these are the students that, actually I get amazed that they're able to concentrate at all. And we try to help them all. When you think of the changes in their own lives, coming to a new school, their homes still not ready, parents going through divorce, it's really amazing that they're able to do what they do. But then there are always those students who really struggle with it all. And then it's our job as counselors to help teachers know who's who, and it works the other way around too. Many times teachers let us know who to look out for, who to help. It's teamwork.
Mike, is there anything that you would like to talk about that we have not discussed?
Yeah, just the overall picture that's still happening down here. And it continues to be news. And that is the lack of mental health professionals going on down here, living down here. We actually were doing quite well. I mean, there's always a need. But the last figure I saw was that 80% the mental health professionals who were living here, working here pre-Katrina, are not here anymore, are gone, and I even know some of them. So there's still a need, and especially in the city of New Orleans, and they have been trying as best we can to get the schools going again, public and parochial. And there's a scramble for teachers, but there's also quite a need for good counselors, social workers, psychologists, and the mental health professionals who are down here are really, really being stretched to the limit because there's no doubt that there are some kids who are not being helped just because of the numbers. You know, we're fortunate where we're at, but as you get into the city and into St. Bernard Parish, there's really a lack of that. And we need people down here. We need professionals in here, especially in the schools.
Right, and with the fact that there are very few school and mental health counselors and community counselors down there, children are being re-traumatized mm-hmm. over and over again because for most of us, Katrina is kind of off the radar.
Yeah.
But for you, it's on the news all the time, every day, in the papers all the time, every day. And these kids are still driving through blighted neighborhoods where houses just have not been restored. Every day.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we approach the anniversary, it sort of magnifies the idea of what happened. Kids are, as you say, constantly being exposed to it because it's constantly around them. And I know whether it's a football game, a retreat, or whatever, or just going to do service projects, yes, we're always going into the city and areas and it's constantly before us on the news, as I was telling you personally, that just every day, you know, the top stories are still Katrina-related, and in particular, the educational issues. So that go along with the post-Katrina world. So yes, the students really they can't get away from it. I taught summer school this year, and on one day I was showing a video that NBC had done on the anniversary of Katrina last year. And I could see with the students that were in class, they had a somber look on their faces. Without being a little dramatic, you see it even kind of re-traumatized them, you know. It just brought back horrible memories. I mean, I had a purpose in showing that film, but you can just see that the memories are still very real, very, very raw, and they're not even memories even. As you say, everything is still here. So, it's still going on.
So what specific types of services, given that a lot of your students would not even be able to find other counselors like mental health counselors if they wanted to help them above and beyond what the school is doing, what services are available for these students in your school or in the Archdiocese?
Well, at Rumble High School, we're just constantly available. A couple of our counselors, in fact, are people who lost everything, are still rebuilding. And so they definitely can empathize with the students who come in. It's been sort of on an individual basis, but what has happened, especially on the senior high level, is that whether it's at lunchtime or it's after school, or even during class, that there are groups that come in, and it turns into a group sharing, group project. We're always inviting, encouraging even the parents, the whole family to come in and sit down. Sometimes they want to do that. It's general counseling services. Just that, you know, we've really been put to the test in a good way since Katrina. We know why we're here. We get this as feedback. The students know that they can come to the counselors at any time. I think a lot of one-on-one, but the group process is definitely available. Sometimes it happens just impromptu. The Archdiocese has definitely been sponsoring some group work. There's a project called the Forward to Lead Project where we can identify students who most in need of counseling services and they're providing group work and individual work on a more serious nature, and they'll need, they have different times that they'll need, whether it's the group work or the individual. So the Archdiocese has definitely been cognizant of the need and offering any help they can give in individual schools and offering services to the students and parents also. So there's been a lot of good reaction from the Archdiocese.
I want to thank you, Mike, for spending some time with us today and catching us up on school counselors in the New Orleans area. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
You've just heard an interview of Michael Baracco, a school counselor from Louisiana, about school counseling post-Katrina.
Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselorAudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4242. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.